You are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Stephen P. Kiernan. Stephen P. Kiernan has published nearly 4 million words, primarily over several decades as a journalist, winning more than 40 awards, including the George Polk Award and the Scripps Howard Award for Distinguished Service to the First Amendment. Author of the novels The Hummingbird and The Curiosity, he has also written two nonfiction books, Last Rites and Authentic Patriotism. Stephen was born in Newtonville, New York, the sixth of seven children. A graduate of Middlebury College, he received a Master of Art degree from Johns Hopkins University and a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. He has chaired the board of the Young Writers Project, served on the Vermont Legislative Committee on Pain and Palliative Care, and is a member of the advisory board of the New Hampshire Palliative Care Initiative. Stephen Kiernan travels the country speaking and consulting on how to expand use of hospice, palliative care, and advanced directives. A performer on the guitar since he was 10 years old, Stephen has recorded three CDs of solo instrumentals and composed music for dance, the stage, and documentary films. He lives in Vermont with his two amazing sons, according to his website bio, which we have to believe. Here's a bit of background on Stephen's new novel. From the acclaimed author of The Curiosity comes a compelling and moving story of compassion, courage, and redemption. Deborah Birch is a seasoned hospice nurse whose daily work requires courage and compassion, but her skills and experience are tested in new and dramatic ways when her easygoing husband, Michael, returns from his third deployment to Iraq, haunted by nightmares, anxiety, and rage. She is determined to help him heal and to restore the tender, loving marriage they once had. At the same time, Deborah's primary patient is Barclay Reed, a retired history professor and expert in the Pacific Theater of World War II, whose career ended in academic scandal. Alone in the world, the embittered professor is dying. As Barclay begrudgingly comes to trust Deborah, he tells her stories from that long ago war, which help her find a way to help her husband battle his demons. Told with piercing empathy and heartbreaking realism, The Hummingbird is a masterful story of loving commitment, service to country, and absolution through wisdom and forgiveness. When I spoke with Stephen P. Kiernan, I asked him to begin by reading from The Hummingbird.
What did it feel like to meet a new client? When I first finished my master's at Portland State, it was all anxiety. Am I worthy? Do I know enough? What if I screw up? But that line of thought rarely happened anymore. I now understood that I was completely unworthy, did not know nearly enough, and could be totally dependent upon to screw up. What mattered was my intention. This job was not about Deborah Birch being perfect, because it was not about Deborah Birch at all. What a concept. How helpfully humbling. The house sat on the lake side of the road, a ranch with cedar siding and white trim. Outside I saw the Beetle belonging to Cheryl, a longtime volunteer. Her husband took 3 years to die of ALS, nurses from our agency holding her hand every agonizing step. The process left Cheryl nearly bankrupt. Afterward, instead of indulging in bitterness, she became a volunteer and was soon our very best. Barclay Reed was lucky to have her. The gardens were manicured, tidy, almost to a fault. One leaf sat on the walkway, dry and curled, otherwise the place was spotless. I nearly bent to pick up that leaf. I was starting to shift into professional mode. Before I'd rung the bell, Cheryl opened the front door. A squat woman wearing a red dress with pink polka dots, plus purple cat's eye glasses. She greeted me with a quick hug. "How's everything going here this morning?" I asked. She looked at me over the top of her glasses. "Deborah, you are about to have your hands full." "That's nothing new," I said. "You'll see. This patient's a prize." She gathered her things into a giant white handbag, pecking my cheek on the way out. "Is the new one here yet?" a voice yelled from inside the house. "Has the latest victim arrived?" I glanced after Cheryl, who was climbing into her bug without a flicker of interest backward. "Good morning, Mr. Reed. I'll be right with you."
"I haven't got all day," he bellowed. "I am dying in here, you know."
"You sound pretty healthy to me," I thought, then stuffed it away. For many people, appearances of strength are the last thing they want to surrender. I followed the sound of his voice to a half-open door on which I knocked.
"Dispense with the formalities, would you please?" he barked. "You'll be wiping my bottom soon enough."
And just like that, I had his number. I'd dealt with tyrants before. Often they turned out to be the ones who were most frightened. Fortunately, worry is a treatable condition. I might be able to help him. I pushed the door open. The room smelled of old newspapers. The man on the bed had burst capillaries on his cheekbones, like upside-down tree roots. His shock of white hair stood straight up. He appeared thin, but not skeletal, with a distended stomach common to liver involvement. Cheryl had left him propped up, a rolling tray to one side that held water and a newspaper, with a cluster of remote controls in his lap. Among them there was, I noticed, no telephone. "A woman," he exclaimed, rolling his eyes. "Yet another woman." "Good morning, Mr. Reed. My name, Dr. Reed, if you please, or Professor Reed, ideally. What are your credentials, may I inquire?" "Oh, well, I'm a registered nurse with a graduate degree in social work." "My, my. And your last name?" "Birch. Deborah Birch. I shall call you Nurse Birch. Did you know that I have already eaten 16 bananas today? What do you make of that?" For someone so sick, he certainly had spark. There was a forward set to his jaw, too, a ferocity that made me like him. "I don't know. 16 seems like a lot of bananas. Should I make something of it?" "Weak evasion, Nurse Birch. But the question," he pointed a bony finger, "the central question is whether or not you believe me."
"Does it matter?"
"Whether or not you believe me? It is the only thing that matters."
"Then I do not believe you."
He folded his hands in his lap.
"Your reasoning?"
"A perfectly healthy person would have a hard time eating more than 5 or 6 bananas, and someone of your age and intelligence would know better than to upset his stomach needlessly." I smiled at him.
"You did not eat 16 bananas today."
He leveled his gaze at me.
"Are you calling me a liar, Nurse Birch, you there with your smug little Cheshire Cat grin?"
"I am calling you a tester, Professor Reed. You are testing me, and I am answering you directly and honestly. So now, how many bananas have you eaten today?"
He peered down at his collection of remotes, stirring them absently.
"I have always detested bananas. I can't abide them, the preferred fruit of baboons, after all."
"Well, if I'm counting correctly, then, Professor Reed, the number of bananas you did not eat today is exactly 16.
He drew himself up at that, giving me a long, appraising glare.
"You," he said at last, crossing his arms on his chest, "you may take my blood pressure."
Great.
Character.
He's a character. Thank you for reading that.
My pleasure.
I'm glad you read that section because there's a little bit before that, but that's quite early in the book. And I was really impressed as I read this at how very quickly you set up the story, the characters. We know them so well. That's page, I think, 12 when you finished there.
Right.
We know them so well already by that point. You know, I was just what you read, her instinct to pick up that leaf. The one thing that's not perfect in his yard. And it would, if you were looking out the window, be something along the lines of the 16 banana comment that would make him like her, right?
Yes.
Just lots of little things like that. So actually, I wondered if we could begin by you talking about how you begin or eventually how you find the beginning of a novel.
How I find the beginning is a somewhat mysterious process that I don't want to know the details of. I don't want to know how it works, as long as it continues to work. What I can tell you is the germ of this novel was an essay I read in the Georgia Review 8 years ago by Barry Lopez about the subterranean racism in nearly all white communities. And he was writing about his native Oregon, mm-hmm. but I was reading it with interest because I live in Vermont, which is the demographically whitest state in America. And most of the essay was about Native Americans who were displaced by white settlement and some of the treatment of Asians after they built the Transcontinental Railway. And then there was just a couple of paragraphs at the end about a Japanese pilot who had come to apologize for dropping bombs on America and how someone decapitated all the posters announcing his visit. And I thought, what? I never heard anything about this. And that started a research project where I thought first I was just going to write a novel about a Japanese pilot apologizing. And it turned out that writing about a pilot is very static. Sitting in the pilot seat, there's not a lot that happens. And so I tucked it away for 8 years, and 7 years, I guess. And then we had a bunch of National Guardsmen returning to Vermont, where I live, and they were not in good shape. And I read about nationally the number of returning soldiers and Marines and airmen and sailors who are dealing with PTSD, whether they received physical injuries or not, that they have an emotional injury. And I thought, boy, that's an interesting thing. There could be a novel in that. And then somehow I thought about connecting that with the Japanese pilot, and that's the mysterious part of the process.
Right, yeah.
And from that came the hummingbird.
Now, the Japanese pilot is, I'm going to want to say his name correctly.
Ichiro Soga.
Thank you. Ichiro Soga. And he's based on a real person. This is the person you read about in the article.
I read about someone named Nabu Fujita, who was a Japanese pilot, yes, and who did come to apologize for his conduct in World War II. And then, you know, I fictionalized his story so that it would suit what the novel is about, which is essentially how does a warrior become a man of peace? Whether it's someone who was an American enemy in 1945, or it's an American soldier returning from Iraq in 2015.
That's really interesting that it went, that was your creative path. All right, I want to just talk a little bit about your characters. Deborah is this incredibly strong character. She has resolve. She's also unusually challenged by what comes her way. Her husband comes back from Iraq with PTSD. It's his third tour, I believe, that really pushes him over the edge, during which he's a sniper. And then she also has this irascible character that she has to take care of, who turns out to be somebody with whom she has a good rapport. But I wonder if you can talk about developing her character and choosing her to be the narrator of this story.
Well, she's the only one who can tell this story of all the people in it. You know, it was an ambitious thing. We can talk about this later if you like. It felt very ambitious for me to have a female narrator, but she's the glue of this story. She's the one who knows the patient and her husband. Mm-hmm. And the patient, this Barclay Reed, possesses a wisdom that she needs in order to help her husband to begin to heal. He's been home 6 months when the book begins. In the 6 months that he's been home, they have not made love. They have barely touched. He is very angry. When we meet him, it's in an incident of violent road rage. He's really in a bad way. But it turns out that this old curmudgeon, in his expertise, his professorship was in his field of study was the Pacific Theater of World War II. And he knows World War II stories that turn out to have lessons that might be healing for her husband. Mm-hmm. And so she tries things out, and for the most part, is successful. In terms of dealing with a patient, that's business as usual for a hospice nurse. They take care of patients. That's what they do. And there's a way that she is really equipped to go toe-to-toe with this irascible character. But each patient has unexpected gifts. This is her belief. Every patient has unexpected gifts that they give to her that is the kind of spiritual recompense for the work that she does. And the gift in this case is the story of the Japanese pilot, which pertains to her husband, and maybe is going to help him turn the corner a little bit.
Yeah. Did you ever consider giving different characters narrative points of view and mixing it up that way, or did you always just want a single storyteller?
Well, you know, my last novel, Curiosity, had four narrators, and I had great fun with that. It's a great challenge of craft, but it really had to serve the story. In this case, I'm down to two narrators, Deborah telling the story, and then the book of Barclay Reed that she reads. And I feel like I've made great progress, that I've gone from four to two. You know, my next book's going to
be just one narrator. That's my goal. One person to tell the story. And I didn't want to, because really Deborah's predicament is our predicament. You know, we've had now a couple million people serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. More than 400,000 of them have been diagnosed with PTSD. They are committing suicide at the rate of 23 a day.
Wow.
And so Deborah is all of us. We are all reckoning with these folks coming home with physical injuries, perhaps with moral injuries, definitely, and emotional injuries and psychic injuries. And how do we care for these folks? And so her dilemma is our dilemma as a society.
Mm-hmm.
So she's the person whose story I needed to tell.
Okay, great. Barclay is also a fantastic character.
Thank you.
I love his irascible nature, and I love his lectures and the way that his lectures calm him. That's something that Deborah notices in the text. Can you talk about writing the story of a person who has no close narrative, the challenges of presenting? I felt like I knew him really well, and his history, his backstory, his relationship with his family, well, as it stands, his family. And also, you know, for Ichiro Soga, you know, I mean, we are getting these stories, we're getting Deborah's story very firsthand, very close narration, mm-hmm. but the other stories we're sort of getting a little bit secondhand, a little bit of distance. So I'm just wondering if you can talk about that challenge.
Yes, let's see. Well, first of all, let me say this. I don't want to give anything away, but I will say that there are two curmudgeons in this book. And the one that we know best is Barclay Reed, and there's one that enters later, and I don't want to give that away.
Right.
But this second curmudgeon is completely unlikable, whereas Barclay Reed has a kind of charm. Even though he's a prickly guy, he's lovable. And I had to figure out what it is that makes some curmudgeons really just kind of jerks, and others where we know that underneath this sandpaper exterior there's a little sweetheart, there's a cupcake inside.
Right.
And what I discovered in the writing of this, which is so fun, you never know when you're writing what you're going to learn from it, what I learned is that it's his vulnerability. You know, you mentioned the leaf on the sidewalk. What that says is there's an imperfection. This guy wants everything buttoned
perfect,
up,
yeah.
But lo and behold, there's a leaf. And even in that bananas thing, you know, they're going back and forth about who's going to have dominance in this. But he is saying, you know, the only important thing is that I be believed.
Right.
And when we know more of his story, we'll find out that being believed is, in fact, the central unresolved dilemma of his life,
right.
Which is nearing its end. And so for him, this novel is about finding out if he can be believed or not. And putting that vulnerability in there somehow then makes him human and lovable. And the other grouchy person in this book doesn't ever reveal any vulnerability, and the likability doesn't happen as a result.
Right.
There was a second part to your question. Forgive me, I forgot.
Oh, no, it was about Soga and telling Soga's story. And, well, actually, I have another question for you about that, and that was, how was it to write a book within a book?
Writing Ichiro Soga's story was great fun for a couple of reasons. One is that I needed to learn a lot before I could write it. The other is, it was a different voice. It was the voice of a scholar. And I wanted to imitate that voice without mocking it. I wanted to imitate it with respect. And the third thing is that his story is a noble one. And there's a way that, because it was a book within a book, I could make it, it would be very hard to write within the main story someone doing incredibly noble things without it feeling really contrived. And instead, I think it feels more organic. It feels like what would really happen
yeah.
with this particular character. And, you know, whenever you write about somebody that's exemplary, what is the, is it Nabokov who says that ideal people or good people are boring? They don't make good stories. And so, you know, so if you're going to write about a guy who behaves with a lot of goodness, having that one step of remove makes it a little bit easier to write about, particularly when there are people around him who aren't buying his goodness at all. They're skeptical as anyone would be.
Right.
And I learned a great deal about World War II that I didn't know. I think we all kind of intuitively have some sense of what went on in Europe because we know roughly where the countries are. We know about Hitler. We know about D-Day, that sort of thing. But the Pacific Theater, you know, I don't think most people can tell how far Guam is from Midway, is from Iwo Jima. You know, it's all kind of abstract over there.
Right.
And so for me, really learning that deeply was really interesting and fascinating. And whenever you do, for me, whenever I do a lot of research, about 1% of it actually makes it into the text of the book. But I think it enriches kind of my confidence for writing that story. And so the challenge was to make it read like Barclay Reed had written it.
Yes.
Not as I had written
absolutely.
It, but Barclay Reed had.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's like a matter of craft that's really kind of fun, about yeah. language mostly.
And then, okay, so you mentioned this. We didn't speak about it specifically, but he is very interested in being believed or capable of being believed. And so part of the reason that is so important to him is a scandal that happened in his academic career. He was accused of plagiarism. And part of this storyline is that he's very interested in her reading this book and telling him if she believes it. And I loved that. I loved that. And it's like you said, it's his vulnerability. It shows that need.
Well, they make a deal. She wants to give him his last wish. And this is her impulse as a professional caregiver and as a person by disposition who is a caregiver. And his last wish is that she read to him from this book, but not look up anything in it to find out if it's true or not. And so she reads without doing any homework just to see. And sometimes he can't wait till the end. And he'll say, what do you think now? What do you think now? Because he can't wait because it just matters so much to him.
Right.
And she doesn't know why quite yet. She just thinks he's kind of a strange curmudgeon.
Right.
And so, in fact, as the novel is, as the Hummingbird is nearing its end, she is nearing the end of this story and she hasn't decided whether or not she believes it. And, you know, I guess part of this is we all want to be believed in the stories that we tell and that have meaning in our lives. And part of it is this character, if he's going to have spiritual calm at the end of his life, it will be by having the question answered, can he be believed? And the little trick of this, and so far it has worked, is that when Deborah agrees not to look it up and find out what's real and not real, is that somehow the reader makes that deal too. And so far, I've been asking people who've read this book, and they don't get halfway along and say, wait, I got to go online and find out if this is true or not. Somehow, they've made the same deal as Deborah,
like,
and they're going to wait and see. Yes, and I didn't know if people would do that. Because you can go online and wreck the ending if you want, or you can stay in the book and find out if Harry beats Voldemort or not. And right, so people seem to be willing to make that deal and to be with Deborah
yeah.
as she discovers whether or not it's true.
Okay, great. Let's see. You mentioned research a minute ago, and I know that you've written books that would have impacted the research that you did on this story, your book on end of life.
Yes.
And that was called Last Rites. And then you had a book called Authentic Patriotism. So how much did you draw on the research from those two books while you wrote this one? And what aspects of research did you have to start fresh with this book?
You know, way back when I was in college, the poet Bob Pack told me that the muse was never harmed by a trip to the library. I always have found that research helps a great deal in making a piece of work vivid. So this book takes place in the Pacific Northwest, mostly in Portland, Oregon, and then south on the Oregon coast. And I've been to Portland before, but never the Oregon coast. So I had to go there and see that, for example. I'm a New Englander. I'm accustomed to a certain kind of driftwood. There it's redwood. So the driftwood is red. It's just different. And you wouldn't know that without going to a place. Likewise, all the historical section about World War II, that was all research. And then there's the hospice piece. You know, 8 years ago I published a book about how people could end their lives with greater peace and dignity and less pain and less expense and less emotional anguish. Last Rites. And after I published that book,
people came up and told me stories of their loved one's demise. And about a quarter or a third of those stories were fantastic, triumphant, surprisingly beautiful conclusions and fulfilling conclusions to people's lives. And the other two-thirds or three-quarters were horrible and were about people being tortured by excessive and futile and bankrupting healthcare and that they didn't want in places where they didn't want to be. And I've been just sort of stockpiling these stories, hearing these stories, bearing witness, feeling a little bit privileged that people have entrusted me mm-hmm. with these stories. And so that was a whole arsenal that I never planned to do anything with except experience and listen. And lo and behold, Deborah has those stories in her too. And all the time, situations arise when she's caring for Barclay Reed, when she's dealing with her husband, even when she's just seeing a woman be grouchy about in the supermarket about the fact that all the egg cartons have one broken egg in them.
Right.
And how she puts that in perspective with patients that she's had through her life and how that has formed her understanding of humanity. And it was a joy to draw on all of those stories that people had told me to enrich her character, to enrich this story as those stories have enriched my life.
Okay, great. Let's see. I was wondering if I could read a couple things and then we could talk about them.
Okay.
Well, okay, actually, there's one part that I don't have to read. At one point, Deborah asks Barclay, why don't men ever talk about war? Mm. And he answers, what you're asking is actually a large question involving cultural norms of manhood and civilized behavior, not to mention a society's capacity to lie to itself. He goes on to enumerate the lies. People think they're being brave. They think silence is self-control. They think that they're being modest. But he says these are all lies to other people and to themselves. I found this so interesting, and I wondered if we could talk about it. I wondered if it was something that you came up with on your own from observing our soldiers coming home, or if it's something you've had conversations about. Where did this come from?
You know, three sources, I guess. One is that it is things that I'd read. Mm-hmm. The second is I interviewed many veterans in the course of working on this book. And the third thing is that I interviewed a woman who for a while supervised the emotional and psychological support programs for returning members of the Vermont National Guard.
Okay.
Who had served. And we have this idea about why soldiers don't speak about their military service. And what Barclay is doing is puncturing that. Now, it's his point of view. It's not my point of view. But it's his point of view that we believe that it is stoicism. It's not so for him. You know, it's interesting. I was this summer, I was at a family reunion, and the topic of my father's ear came up. My father served in the Pacific Theater in World War II, and there was an incident in which the top third or so of one of his ears was cut off, which I imagine was a pretty painful thing. And there I was with my brothers and sisters, and we were all comparing notes about how we thought Dad lost his ear. And lo and behold, we had a lot of different versions. Nobody knew for sure. And it turns out he probably never really told us, like, this happened and I lost my ear and this is what I, you know. And it was a minor deformity. You had to look closely to see. We never knew. And so some of that, yeah, that's him being tough. That's him, like, don't be scared about your dad. Some of that is the war was a long time ago, and emotionally I want to put it as far in the past as I can. But when people don't talk about combat experience, a piece of it is, you know, Tim O'Brien writes about this beautifully in Going After Cacciato and the things they carried. There is, you know, one of the characters here discovers that when he kills someone that he's proud of it. And he didn't know that he was capable of murder, much less of enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And that's very morally confusing to him, being a really kind of highly moralistic guy at home, or at least a guy with a really strong conscience at home, to find he was glad to have caused certain deaths. And that's a very complicated thing to return home to among people who would not have any understanding of the degree of stress and fear and pressures and camaraderie and all these very powerful forces
while they're armed to the teeth. And so there are two people that speak in this book about what's going on. And that moment with Barclay Reed is one. There's another one that happens at a shooting range where a Vietnam veteran is talking about how everyone in America is a member of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And when he carries on about that, you know, he's a man with a lot of emotional difficulties. He's got his own PTSD from Vietnam. But I think there's a grain of truth in there about how we all support the military and how we all support the military, some of which is good and some of which is not so good. I love these characters sounding off like this, not because this book is preachy, I certainly hope it's not, but because there are ways of looking under the rock and seeing what's there, and oh boy, it's more complicated than we thought. It's not just these veterans come back and they're
right.
being macho. It turns out it's a lot more complicated than that.
Right. To speak to the preachiness, I think one thing that really helped you, because you wanted to express certain thoughts on the part of Barclay, and you made him someone who lectures, but you made her someone who's curious and asks him questions and wants to know more. And so the reader is along for that ride without thinking, oh my God, you know, Ayn Rand, shut up.
Right? Yes, and also, you know, she's not curious because she's by nature a curious person. She's curious because her husband's a mess and she
right.
really wants to help him.
This is a very specific.
And so her motivation is, you know, it's an appetite. She is hungry to understand things about, I mean, in that conversation, for example, you referenced when she says, why don't men talk about war? What she's really saying is, why won't my husband talk
about
these 31 faces that he stays up all night drawing over and over obsessively? He won't tell me what they're about. He won't tell me the story of one of these 31 faces. Why won't he do that? And what Barclay really says is, it's not because he's being stoic.
Mm.
It's not because he's brave.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's really complicated in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also where suddenly the two of them, who were adversaries in the part that I read, now are kind of working towards something together. They've begun to work
right.
towards something together.
Although I think at the end of what you read, they're already starting to figure out that there might be room for that. You are a journalist by training.
Yes.
You wrote many years for the Burlington Free Press.
Yes.
So how does that help your work? How does that feed your writing novels?
Well, you know, I worked at worked for other newspapers as well, and did magazine work over the years. And
which other newspapers?
I worked for the Daily Island in Iowa City.
Okay.
And I've done some work for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine
okay.
over the years. And but I guess there are a couple of things. The first is just spending time with sentences. And that sounds dull, I'm sure, but the plain truth is that a sentence is a unit of thought. And if you can render a sentence clearly, it means that you thought something clearly. And I've had about 4 million words in print now. You know, that's a lot of sentences where I've needed to sort of organize my thinking to what is this, what clarity can I bring to this idea, and then the next idea, and then, and here's a simple idea, and here's a complex one, and here's a compound complex idea. Like, it's a real mouthful, so here's another simple one. And working with all of that, it's just like arrows in your quill when it comes to writing fiction. That language is a familiar tool. That rhythm is a familiar device. And even that putting your butt in the chair
mm-hmm.
when you're not having a good writing day and getting pages out is also a sustainable discipline. So it's helped a lot. The great advantages, of course, you know, when you're a reporter and you go to cover the Lieutenant Governor's news conference and it's boring, you still have to write about it. But when you're a novelist, if the Lieutenant Governor's news conference is boring, you just don't write a word about it. It just doesn't appear. In fact, he's cut from the whole book. And so there's a great liberation there that you're no longer beholden to reality. You're allowed to use art. You're
right.
allowed to be discerning. And so it's great fun. It's great fun to be writing fiction at this point.
That's great. Do you plan to write any more nonfiction books?
Well, plan is an interesting word choice for me because it means that all this would be much more intentional than, you know, as if I had sort of a strategy about this. I can tell you that I am, you know, 100 pages long in my next book, which is a novel.
Okay.
I can also tell you that in the course of the research for this novel, I met a great character from American history that nobody knows about. And I am sorely tempted to tell his story because he's just a great larger-than-life character. So I hope that I continue to write both things. Right now, the compulsion to write novels, the drive to tell story, is so strong that I think I'm going to be doing that for the foreseeable future. You know, most writers, I think, struggle with times of writer's block, and I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, but for me, I struggle with the enormous flow of ideas and the fact that books take a long time to write, a lot of hours. Mm-hmm. And so I will never write all the ideas that are in my head.
Have you started books that you decided not to continue with?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have 4 or 5 whole books that I wrote that never got published.
Okay.
Because I had to figure out how to write a novel. And one of them was not bad, and the others, I believe I have destroyed every copy that exists. There was a book that I was 250 pages along in, and it really was losing steam, and I was struggling, and a friend of mine persuaded me to put that aside and do to begin The Hummingbird. That's a very dangerous thing, because when you put something aside, at least for me, I don't go back.
Yeah.
And so I never have gone back to finish that, even though I'm 250 pages along, because as soon as I started The Hummingbird and I had these two people sparring about bananas on page 12, I was in. So yes, I often will write my way into a corner and say, no, this book isn't going to happen.
Not working.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so now I am going to read a little something. I love thinking while I'm reading about the different ways that people convey plot. You know, there's narrative, but there's a lot of different ways to convey plot. And a couple of them showed up just on these two pages, and I thought I would read from them. Deborah, after our first day with her, she goes home and realizes that her husband is in police custody. And so she goes to the station, and eventually when she gets to speak to the police, the man in uniform cleared his throat and stroked his bushy mustache downward. "Your husband committed vehicular assault today, Mrs. Birch. Everyone is unharmed physically, thank goodness, but we still have a situation to deal with. Is Michael all right? Where is he?" "We'll take you to him in just a moment." The policeman tapped his pen on the table. "Apparently what happened..." "It was road rage," the other man at the table interrupted. He was older, his mustache as white as ice. He was wearing a turquoise Seahawks t-shirt. "He got pissed at me for some reason. I have no idea why. And he rammed me." And the scene goes on, and it's all in dialogue, and we get a lot of information about the plot through that dialogue. And then later, they start asking her about who Michael is, and she tells them about his... they know that he was in the service from his bumper stickers. He served 3 deployments. And then eventually they say, "How many kills did he have?" "I sat back in my chair. Did they really want to know? Did they want to hear about the nightmares? Should I describe for them how he had not touched me intimately, not once in the 5 months since he'd returned? Maybe I should recite to them the suicide statistics from the war, or inform them that there had been an error, that the real Michael Birch was left behind in the sand somewhere, and would they please go and find him and bring him back to me?" These were just two small moments on 2 pages where we learn a lot about her marriage and about Michael and what's going on with him and what's happened to him that day through dialogue and through her introspection. So I just wonder if we could talk about conveyance of plot.
Sure. I mean, the first thing is that you want it to be invisible. You spotted 2 moments when it wasn't invisible. But I think... let's take the first moment. The first moment, I use almost a playwriting device, which is that she asks the question, "Where's my husband? Is he okay?" This is now a question that's been asked in the reader's imagination. And what the policeman says is, "We'll take him to you in a little while," meaning... you're not getting your answers right now. This is not about answering your questions. And now that hook is planted. And for the reader, it's okay to have a couple of sentences that reveal plot, because that hook matters. You know, she doesn't know exactly what happened, but she saw his banged up truck. You know, she knows she's at a police station. People are not talking to her until she gets into this interrogation room. And so she wants to know if her husband's okay, and she's not getting a straight answer. Like, the reader wants a straight answer, too. So there's a way that hook will get me by a couple of sentences. The second time, which is more internal, I guess 2 things. One is that she sits back from the table, which is a physical gesture that is saying, I'm not engaging this conversation the same way. I'm now stepping back from this conversation. And then I think that gives the narrative voice, gives her an opportunity and kind of permission to be interior, which is to say, Do they understand what kind of condition this guy is in? And then, more sort of authorially, does anyone understand the number of people that are damaged by their service? And that is a very important framing element for all of the novel that follows. I mean, that's also, what, 15 pages in or something? That's pretty early.
Yeah,
and it's
30.
Okay. It's really framing a lot of what's going to happen. And the goal is to have that stuff happen, appear in the text in a way where the reader doesn't notice. Because both of those moments are a little bit of an interruption in the dream, in the reader's movie that they imagine in his or her mind. And so to have that interruption, I need to have something that makes them happy to put up with it for a couple of sentences so they can get to, you know, the question is, how many kills did he have? Well, now, you know, we haven't, the reader at that point has not met Michael yet. We know there's been a road rage incident. We know he's under arrest. He's being held somewhere in this police station. How many kills did he have? And that's another hook where I can pause for a minute and say, well, what do they really want to know?
And the pause creates suspense in a small moment, just
yes.
in the same way that big, larger, different kinds of pauses create suspense in different kinds of books.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly that, is that the reader has an appetite for that suspense to be resolved. And I'm not going to resolve it for a moment. so that I can get this little bit of plot information advanced.
Right.
And then I'm, you know, I love my reader. I want to you know, give the information eventually, just a sentence or two later.
Okay. All right, great. And I want to read one more thing. And this isn't actually even a question. This is the story of another patient she had, a patient that Deborah took care of named Mona.
Oh.
Mona's a tough story, and I actually just want to read this because I found this to be so beautiful, and just it totally brought me into this moment. Okay. After 4 or 5 days, I found myself dreading the stops at Mona's house. In the evening, there were always people out on the porch drinking, often straight from the bottle. They would stop talking the moment I closed my car door. Although the men didn't bother to hide checking me out, no one greeted me, even if I said hello. Instead, they made a cloud of cigarette smoke so thick I had to hold my breath as I passed through. I felt the heat of their stares and sometimes heard a muttered wisecrack and snickering after I had gone inside. And I'm not actually getting into the story of Mona, which is a very affecting and moving story and sad story. But just that moment in time, just I was on that porch with her, and I feel like you did a lot of just presenting detail that brought us into that scene. So I guess I'm mostly just saying I enjoyed a lot about this book, and that's an example of one part.
Thank you. You know, what the most courageous thing, I think, maybe foolhardy, but it turned out okay, I guess, thing that I did in the writing of this book is to have a female narrator. And if you think about a woman stepping into that circumstance, inside that house is a patient who is terminally ill, and she has a kind of tumor that would be excruciatingly painful if the pain were not managed in a very innovative way. And Deborah's particular area of expertise is pain management. So here is this household that is full of dysfunction, and alcohol abuse and drug abuse and cruelty of all kinds. And she is walking through that, even though she feels great fear and difficulty walking through that, to get to her patient. And in the end, she does something wrong. And the patient suffers enormously. And this story, this experience is going to be with her for the rest of her life. Part of it is to show she's not perfect.
Mm.
Part of it is to show how much courage she has. And then there is just what it is to be this nurse with a graduate degree in social work who can banter with the professor. And that's not how it always is.
Right.
Sometimes it's pretty gritty. And here are these people who couldn't care less that she's there to take care of the cancer patient inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I get away with having a female narrator, it is because actually it's very human to have that be a scary moment. And for her to know that she's being checked out, you know, we can guess what the muttering is that gets a snicker from people. But she holds on to her dignity. And
You know, I think that reminds me of those videos of the woman walking down the street in New York City and all the men catcalling that we saw a couple of years ago, right? It was all over social media. That's part of what it is to be a certain kind of woman in America now. And makes her
and always.
Cool. Yeah.
Let's see. At one point, Barclay sums up something about the relationship that he and Deborah have formed. It's toward the end of the book. I'm not going to give away anything at the end of the book. I don't like to do that in interviews, but I loved this line. He said, "Here is a concrete manifestation of that truth, and it is something no other person on earth would comprehend. Only we understand." He's just saying, you know, you can't put our relationship into the cliche of a patient and a nurse. You know, it's like the way that we've interacted with each other is a specific, unique experience, and only we understand. I loved that he said this, and I felt like at the end of the, certainly through the journey of the book, you had become very fond of them.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Yes. And that he would arrive at that. She would know that because, you know, she had a different patient a month before, mm-hmm. and she'll have another patient a month later. But so she knows this, but that he arrived at that, mm-hmm. Is a softening of him. Likewise, there's one scene where there's someone in his house with whom he has conflict, and that person's going to come in and talk to him in his room. And he says to her, says to Deborah, "Don't leave." Mm-hmm. And she says, "I wouldn't think of it." And the conflict happens, and the other person leaves, and he basically, very begrudgingly, he's angry about something, and she says, "What is it?" And he says, "Oh, something I hate to admit." And she says, "What is it?" And he says, "I'm glad that you're here." And there is that vulnerability again. There's
right.
that leaf on the sidewalk. And, you know, it makes my heart break for him.
Right.
And it also makes me love him.
Yeah. And do you ever feel, when you're writing about characters who become real on the page, do you ever feel a little bit out of control at that point? Like, once they start to become fully realized as characters, do you feel like it's inevitable what's about to happen, or do you still feel like you could make him get up and walk away and be healed?
Yes. Yes. Praise him, he will be healed. There is, you know, what some of the people say, character is destiny. You know, that there's a certain way in which once the character has emerged, you know, you think you know what this person is when you begin. At least I do. And then, of course, all kinds of, and it's very simple, it's very clear, and then after about 10 pages, it's a complete mess, and it's very complex, and all their motives and language and perceptions, it's out of control. And then there's a point in which they are a very specific personality that is quite vivid, mm-hmm. in my imagination, and if it's any good, in the reader's imagination. And then they almost have, like, their rules of behavior. And if they're going to break those rules of behavior, there has to be a clear reason, or I've kind of broken the contract I've made with the reader, that they will be this way. And so then, it's not that it's out of my control. I know roughly where the book is headed, and I know for sure where it arrives. But how we get there changes as you find that the professor, for example, is willing to lie to save someone anguish.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that a man for whom being believed was so important would have one really good lie in him to help someone else.
Yeah.
And that it would be almost a generous kind of lie. And so likewise, there's a way that Deborah really is determined to wrestle with whether or not the story from World War II is true or false, that she's not going to go find out. And she gets to the end, and she's walking around the house going, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But she actually was going to struggle. I didn't know that she would struggle. I thought she would just say, well, he's a dying man. I'll say I believe it, and that'll sort of placate him. But that she really was going to bring integrity. I'm not saying you're a liar. I'm saying you're a tester.
Mm-hmm.
And you're testing me, and I'm answering you directly and honestly. And that would still be true on page 300 as it was on page 10. And their consistency is a delight. And when I'm rewriting, if I see them do something that isn't them, it really sticks out on mm-hmm. the page. It really falls very flat. It really feels like the author is pushing this story in this direction instead of letting it evolve. And somehow it does arrive where it needs to arrive. And I don't exactly know how, Sometimes I wish I did. It would make it simpler. But, you know, my strength is in rewriting. And so I write first drafts, and then I figure out...
Do you write them quickly?
I do, very quickly. I wrote the first draft of this in a little under 6 months. Really fast. To me, that's lightning fast.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I got to the end that I realized what this book was about and what these characters were like. So the first thing you do is say, oh, this is what Barclay Reed is like. And you go back to the beginning and make him like that all the way through.
Right.
This is what Deborah's like, and now she's like that all the way through. This is what Michael's like. He was the hardest, actually, to understand really clearly. One of the things I decided as I went through this in revision, for example, is this is not a war story. There are one or two scenes that Michael remembers, but this is a coming home story. This is not a battle story. This is about loyalty and love.
Mm-hmm.
This is about a wife trying to help her husband who's really in a bad way and doesn't want help. This is about a nurse trying to help a patient who has big issues that have nothing to do with his cancer. And she, in both cases, her loyalty and loving compassion is tested. That's really what it's about. And I didn't know that until I got to the end and said, all the war stuff, I'm going to cut out. This is not about the war.
Okay.
This is about what's happening stateside after the war. And I don't really have that clarity. I'm just not smart enough. I don't have that clarity until I've written the whole book. And then I say, oh, that's it. And then I go back and rip it apart and put it together so it says what it actually intended to be.
Right, right. So, you know, hearing what you're saying about how it's not a book about war, let's just spend 1 minute talking about the cover. It's a beautiful cover.
Thank you. Thank you, but I didn't design it.
You didn't design it. But it's not a cover about war. It's not necessarily a cover about cancer. Talk about your reaction to the cover.
Well, okay. The first thing I'll tell you is, I'm pretty low maintenance as far as my publisher would tell you, my editor would tell you. I'm pretty low maintenance.
Right.
Most of the time. But I'm a stickler about covers. I think they matter so much. And The Curiosity, my last novel, had terrific cover.
Yeah.
Yes, and that was because I was a pain in the neck and turned away a lot of covers. The same with this one. We went through this. They were showing me design after design after design that had a bird on the cover, and I just said, there's no... Women may buy this book, but there's no male on earth that's going to pick up a book that has a picture of a silhouette of a hummingbird on it. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
And this is bigger than that. This has got a larger scale than that, too. It's not that intimate a story. So we went back and forth, and then I found out that there's a whole art department at William Morrow, which is part of HarperCollins, right, this huge publisher, and that the people working on this had never been to the Oregon coast. And I was like, oh, so I sent them some pictures of the Oregon coast after months of working on this cover and kind of fighting about this cover, and within about 3 hours, they'd come up with this, very close to this exact design. It's beautiful, and I think it looks like a John Steinbeck.
It's
book.
Wonderful.
You know,
it's really a wonderful great. Cover. Is the plane superimposed, or did they find this picture?
I don't know the answer.
Okay.
I don't know the answer. Yeah. I don't know the answer. I know that we moved the frame around a little bit to where the plane would be,
yeah.
And I wanted it off-center because that's me. But I love this cover now because there is a lift to it. There is a sort of, here's the scale of this.
Yeah.
And some people have thought that the hummingbird was the name of the airplane. But
which is a fine misconception,
exactly,
because you
right.
know within 5 pages that's not the case.
Right. You find out what the initial
whatever makes
is.
You pick up the book.
That's right.
That's
and
fine.
So to me, it's beautiful and beguiling, which is kind of what you want a cover to be, and that is the Oregon coast, which is very dramatic. That's actually not the most dramatic piece of coastline, but that photo does show the expanse of it. It's a beautiful part of America that I hadn't been to, and there are reasons within the book. Where it must occur there.
Sure.
So I'm happy with that, and they came up with this funky font that looks like it's from the 1920s.
Yeah.
And
it's very Fitzgerald.
Yes,
isn't it?
It is. It is. And people said Steinbeck, people said Fitzgerald, and I think if they want to compare my book to those, I am all good
that's fine.
With that. That's right. But I can't take any credit, really, because I'm not the visual guy, and there is an art department that did a beautiful job here.
Well, it sounds like they asked for your approval, and that means you can actually claim to have been involved.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. But they're the ones with the art. I'm more like the thorn in their side.
Okay. What are you reading these days that you might recommend, or is there anything that you've read recently?
Well, I'm pretty deeply reading in research
for my next novel, but I have been on the road being on tour, and so I've had some very good reading time, and I recently loved Symphony for the City of the Dead, mm-hmm. which is a story of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, which he wrote during the siege of Leningrad.
Oh, wow.
And there are ways that his family could have been lifted out of there, and instead he stayed among incredible poverty and starvation because it was necessary to him for the creation of this. And I never have understood how a symphony could be a political thing, and now I totally get it. I enjoyed that very much. I just read, because E.L. Doctorow had died, a friend gave me The March, which is his novel about Sherman's march across Georgia and the North in the Civil War. It's a terrific novel, not new. Right, that's, I don't know, 4 or 5 books ago for him. And then I've been reading a great, great deal for the next novel that I'm writing. There's one book that I read recently in Galley that I'd like to mention.
Sure.
It's called The Guest Room, and it's by Chris Bojalian. And I think it comes out in January.
Okay.
But it's terrific. The reason I like it so much is that it is a story of some ordinary guys doing something a little bit naughty, and it completely explodes on them, and they are suddenly in real trouble, and they have unknowingly brushed up against real badness, and it's very compelling. And,
okay. The Guest Room.
Yes, I blasted through that thing. It's a terrific book.
Okay, yep. Wonderful. The dialogue in this book is wonderful, and so I want to just end by asking you for advice on writing dialogue, because a lot of the listeners of the show are writers, and so I always tend to ask for advice for writers. So I wonder if you can speak to dialogue a little bit.
Well, I'm delighted to hear you say that you like the dialogue, because it's a thing I really struggle with.
Is it?
Yes. I spend a great deal of time on dialogue, and for me, dialogue works best with two things. And one is really knowing the characters well enough that I know what language they use and don't use, and the size ideas that they speak in, and verbal tics that are part of their character. And I will have even a minor character have a particular way that they speak, and I think a lot about that. And the second thing is, I try not to accomplish too much in dialogue. I often will write dialogue, for example, and in revision, take out 2/3.
Oh, really?
And because I always overstate it. Especially, if I have two people arguing in dialogue, it just gets shrill so fast. And what I end up doing is, it's the time that I am most deliberate in my writing. If I'm just telling story, I just write it, and I know I'll fix it at rewrite, and multiple rewrites. But when I'm writing dialogue, I really make myself slow down. Sometimes I even turn away from the computer and write it longhand to force myself to slow down, because when characters are arguing or in conflict, the temptation to get histrionic or to really turn up the violins or something like that is so high, and it happens, and it doesn't work. I'm thinking about a scene I was working on yesterday, and these two characters, they go right to yelling and shouting, and it's just, no. There needs to be an arc within that conversation, just like there needs to be an arc within every scene, within every chapter, within every book. So if you think about all the way back at the beginning of our conversation, that scene where he says, "Are you calling me a liar?"
Right.
Only because I was going slowly, handwriting, did I have the presence of mind to have her not say, "I'm not saying you're a liar,"
right,
or to respond at all, but instead for her to have complete self-possession and say, "I am calling you a tester." And that's her language. It's a language she would use. And she's responding very directly to him. It's part of their game that he's trying to find angles in, and she's just trying to stay on course. And it's only by making myself slow down and thinking about what her language would be. In fact, she doesn't just say, "I'm calling you a tester." She says, "You are testing me, and I'm answering you directly and honestly," which is her definition of how you would answer a tester. I mean, she's really in her hospice nurse way of thinking and expressing. And in the same way, when he says, "You and your little smug little Cheshire Cat grin," that he uses the word smug. Cheshire Cat is a reference to Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. I mean, that he's speaking in his way of thinking, too.
Right.
For me, I can only do that if I slow way down and understate and feel like dialogue has enough power that I can understate. And still, it is the part of every book that I spend the most time honing and honing and honing and working on. And it can always use one more round of sandpaper and one more coat of varnish to try and get it right, because so much character is revealed in dialogue that I want to make sure it's as consistent as I can make it.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear you say that. A lot of times when you ask people for advice about dialogue, they say, go out into a restaurant and listen to how people talk. And yes, you can get good lines that way, or you can understand something about how people interact. But I don't think real dialogue is like book dialogue.
No, one is reality and the other is art.
Yeah. And you have to take out a lot of reality to get to the heart of art, I think.
Yes.
Right? So that's great advice. I just want to finish by saying again, this was an interview with Stephen P. Kiernan. His book is The Hummingbird. It's a novel published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for speaking with
me. Entirely my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stephen P. Kiernan. I don't know if you noticed, but the plane flew over at the very end, which was fitting. You can learn more about Stephen's work at his website, stephenpkiernan.com, and that's Stephen with a PH. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Stephen P. Kiernan. As a journalist, he wrote a Sunday column for the Burlington Free Press for many years. He had to write 102 column inches for that column each week. It had to be 102, not 101, and not 103. He found that by focusing on concision and by putting pressure on the language, he was able to move a longer article from 108 or 110 column inches up to the 102 that he needed. And often, removing a single word from higher up in a paragraph could result in the deletion of a widow or a single hanging word that lengthened his column by one line. Now a novelist, as you just heard, Stephen continues this practice of putting pressure on the language, getting rid of the widows, the words that take up a whole line at the bottom of a paragraph. He tests himself to see how much he can cut and still retain the best of his prose. And, of course, this exercise generally results in a much leaner, clearer narrative. So try it. Challenge yourself to remove all your widows, not necessarily by deleting those particular ending words in a paragraph, but by finding ways to make those paragraphs more concise and bringing those widows up onto the line proceeding. If this is confusing to you and you need a visual, I will put an example of this exercise on the podcast site so that you can see what I'm talking about. So thanks to Stephen P. Kiernan for that wonderful and unique prompt. And good luck with this. And please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. Also by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host, Gary Lee Miller, is back next week with his next show, and his website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest for 2016, we are booked for 2015, but if you have a guest to suggest for 2016 or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. The Radiator is built on the work of volunteers. More information about getting involved is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.